This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug, ignored a leaky faucet, pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Marine Le Pen's rise to the top of the French presidential polls has been a surprise, but she's touched a nationalist, anti-immigrant nerve. And if she wins, Muslim dress, like the so-called burkini, a full-body swimsuit for women, would be banned in public.
France isn't burkinis on the beach. France is Brigitte Bardot.
Should Muslim people be allowed to wear headscarves?
No, I'm opposed to wearing headscarves in public places. That's not France.
33 men and women were killed when the American ship El Faro vanished in the Bermuda Triangle during a massive hurricane. Found at a depth deeper than the Titanic, the ship was upright, but from the mangled name on her stern to her bow, all 791 feet revealed a savage beating. Tonight, investigators share El Faro's final moments.
You were listening to the voices of the lost and you knew it.
Yes. Yes. And that was really tough to listen to.
These caged lions have never had it so good. They got to this temporary rescue center thanks to the unrelenting efforts of Jan Creamer and Tim Phillips. Creamer and Phillips told us all 24 lions here had been repeatedly beaten in traveling circuses. The lions sounded like they wanted to tell us themselves. This was the first time we had an interview interrupted by roaring.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Bill Whitaker.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
We begin tonight with a story about a populist politician who rails against free trade, wants to get tougher on immigration, is skeptical of NATO, and sympathetic to Russia. We're talking about a woman named Marine Le Pen, the candidate in France's upcoming presidential election, who shocked the political establishment with her meteoric rise. Shocked because the name Le Pen has long been associated with anti-Semitism and racism in Europe. Her party, the National Front, used to be on the fringes of French politics, But in recent years, Marine Le Pen has given it a makeover. And she's now riding a wave of populist anger sweeping the West, with Britain's vote to leave the European Union and the election of President Trump. And just like Mr. Trump's rise, the rise of Marine Le Pen is turning conventional political wisdom on its head.
The polls say you can't win.
Yes. They also said that Brexit wasn't going to happen, that Donald Trump wasn't going to be elected, wasn't even going to be his party's nominee. Well, they're saying that less and less now. They are much more cautious, much more cautious now.
The nationalist policies Marine Le Pen embraces are gaining supporters throughout France and around the world. Is hostile to free trade, rejects open borders, and says globalization, promoted for decades by France's political elites, is destroying her country.
So how do you explain what is happening? Did leaders go too far?
Yes, of course they've gone too far. Globalization has become an ideology with no constraints. And now nations are forcing themselves back into the debate. Nations with borders we control, with people that we listen to, with real economies, not Wall Street economies, but rather factories and farmers. And this goes against unregulated globalization, a wild, savage globalization. Yes, savage, of course. Wild globalization has benefited some, but it's been a catastrophe for most.
A catastrophe, she says, which has ravaged the French economy as jobs have faded away and immigrants have flooded in. Many of them Muslim immigrants from North Africa, who Le Pen says are draining resources, rejecting French values, and transforming the culture.
One of the concerns of many of your supporters is that immigration, current immigration, is changing the character of France. It's changing the spirit of the country.
It's because of this massive immigration and more in some places. France's image has undeniably changed. There are a number of neighborhoods where you are no longer living a French life. That's undeniable.
France is still a country of bistros and fine Bordeaux, baguettes and bucolic churches. But immigrants now make up 12% of the population, and they brought with them new beliefs and customs. Couscous and kebabs, headscarves, and an outfit called the burkini, a full-body swimsuit for Muslim women that's become the latest flashpoint in a raging culture war. We were surprised at just how far Marine Le Pen was willing to go to enforce assimilation.
France isn't burkinis on the beach. France is Brigitte Bardot. That's France.
Should Muslim people be allowed to wear headscarves?
No, I'm opposed to wearing headscarves in public places. That's not France. There's something I just don't understand. The people who come to France, why would they want to change France? To live in France the same way they lived back home?
It's not just headscarves. Le Pen says she would ban yarmulkes in public, any conspicuous symbol of religious belief.
Would a Sikh person allowed to wear a turban?
No, not in public. We don't have a lot of Sikhs in France. We've got some. But we don't really hear much from them or about them, which is good news.
Her views go to the heart of a debate that's been raging in the country for decades over what it means to be French and who's responsible for the failure of some immigrants to become fully integrated into French society.
Massive immigration brings with it cultures that are sometimes in contradiction with our values.
There are many people in France who view your party as anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim.
I'm not waging a religious war. It's clear that in France, everyone has the right to practice their religion, to worship as they choose. My war is against Islamic fundamentalism.
Le Pen blames fundamentalism, but also immigration, for the terror attacks in France that have killed more than 200 people in the last 2 years, though half of the attackers were actually born in the country. She wants to shut down the mosques that she says encourage fundamentalism, tighten borders, drastically reduce legal immigration, and expel all illegal immigrants.
You're talking about deporting them.
Expulsion. It's the law. It's French law.
There's a lot of fear among some immigrants about the idea of you becoming president.
I think a lot of people are trying to scare them, but in reality, they have nothing to fear. You know, people who behave need not worry. Foreigners in France who hold a job, who respect our laws, our codes, have absolutely nothing to worry about.
Many people are worried, though, because the Le Pen name carries a lot of baggage in France. Her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, is a political pugilist and provocateur who co-founded the National Front in the early 70s. The party became a haven for racists and anti-Semites. Jean-Marie Le Pen famously dismissed the Nazi gas chambers as a mere detail of history. And courts have repeatedly found him guilty of questioning the Holocaust. He is a despised figure. One night when Marine was 8, a massive bomb was detonated just outside the family apartment. Incredibly, no one was killed. She took us back to her old neighborhood and the site of the attack.
The building was torn apart. The back of the building was completely destroyed.
Were you inside at the time?
Yes, we were sleeping, and the bomb went off at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's really strange. I have not been back for 40 years. Never.
Her father's bigotry cast a long shadow. At school, Le Pen says teachers who resented his politics took it out on her. She had to develop a thick skin at an early age.
It was my first entry into politics.
You're prepared for anything.
I think so, yes.
Jean-Marie Le Pen ran for president 5 times, but was never able to be anything more than an opposition figure. When Marine took over his National Front party in 2011, she began rebranding it, banishing party members who made anti-Semitic remarks. It was a process that came to be known as the de-demonization of the National Front. 2 years ago, in a move worthy of Shakespeare, she kicked her own father out of the party he founded.
Do you have any contact with him?
No, I don't have any contact with him now. We broke up. Broke up politically. It was a very clear decision on my part to have a political break, which he turned into a family breakup, a personal breakup. And that was his choice.
Le Pen is now a practiced politician.
Expulser tout étranger qui exprime des sympathies pour l'État islamique.
As a member of the European Parliament, she spent years polishing her persona as a straight-talking working mom and French everywoman, doing her best to make people forget her party's past.
It's interesting, when you go to a Marine Le Pen rally or you look at her posters, you don't see her last name. You don't even see the name of the party very much.
But she's right. If she wants to succeed, she must cut all links with that past. She is the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen. And for her, that's an obstacle.
Nona Meyer is a professor in Paris and considered a leading authority on the National Front.
She's tainted because of her last name.
Yes, she is a Le Pen. That was.
And in France, that name is still toxic.
Yes.
But Meyer says that while her father and his anti-Semitic rhetoric may be gone, the nationalist ideology of the National Front hasn't really changed.
There have been cosmetic changes.
Cosmetic changes.
For the rest, at the heart of the party, the very base of its message, it's the idea that you're going to keep the jobs, social benefits, employment, all will be reserved to the French citizens.
French citizens, instead of immigrants to the country, will have priority over access to jobs, housing, welfare.
Everything. You have two kinds of people living in France, the French and the others.
That view of French society, us versus them, is gaining new converts among people who never would have considered voting for the National Front before. We've tried other candidates, Emmanuel Regnault says. There's only one person we haven't tried, and that's Marine. So we say, let's give her a shot. In a country with 10% unemployment, twice what it is in the U.S., Le Pen has built a stronghold in the northern Rust Belt, where factories have closed and jobs have disappeared. While she may be a candidate of the far right, Some of her policies come straight out of the playbook of the French left.
Pour remettre la France sur pied, s'il vous plaît. Avec Marine pour remettre...
She promises more government benefits and greater worker protections.
When Donald Trump says make America great again, are you saying make France great again?
Well, yes, of course. I've been saying that for many years. We are a great nation, which has a lot to offer to the world. But to offer something to the world, France has to remain France.
She calls for a radical shift in the country's foreign policy, vowing to renegotiate its membership in the European Union, or else leave altogether, a move that could result in the breakup of the EU. And just like President Trump, she's questioned the role of NATO and advocates closer ties with Russia.
Hurrah!
What is your admiration for Russia, for Vladimir Putin?
Look, I'm not a fan in a rock concert, you see. I am a political leader in a great nation of the world. What interests me are France's interests.
You don't believe Russia is a threat for Europe?
I don't believe that at all. I think that's a big scam.
Invasion in Ukraine, invasion of Crimea.
I'll tell you what the danger is for Europe. It's carrying out a Cold War against Russia and pushing Russia into China's arms. That's the threat to Europe.
You don't think Vladimir Putin, though, is a killer, is a threat to France, to others in this region?
No, I don't believe it is so. Nothing Vladimir Putin has done would make me reach that conclusion.
Her views on Russia and Vladimir Putin have drawn scrutiny, particularly because 3 years ago, a Russian bank loaned her more than $11 million to fund her party.
Your critics will say that that influences you in your opinion of Russia.
Why would it influence me? When you take out a loan, what's your obligation other than paying it back? You have no other obligation. But if you know an American bank that wants to lend me money, by all means, because I'm still looking for funds, particularly since French banks, for political reasons, have refused to give us a loan to allow us to campaign.
That Russian loan and a widening probe into her party's finances have not quieted the frenzy that now follows Marine Le Pen everywhere. With less than 2 months to go before the first votes are cast, she and her party are closer to power than ever.
Vive le peuple! Vive la République! Vive la France!
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
33 men and women were killed when the American ship El Faro vanished in the Bermuda Triangle. In Spanish, El Faro means the lighthouse, but when she sank in 2015, no beacon led to her resting place. The families of the crew were desperate for answers. Why did the captain sail into a hurricane? Why couldn't the ship survive? Getting to the bottom of a mystery lying deeper than the Titanic was up to the National Transportation Safety Board. Last year, we showed you the hunt for El Faro. Now, investigators have a wealth of new evidence because they have heard the voices of the lost. Exploring the mystery off the Bahamas took 10 months of patience, millions of dollars, and technology able to reach 3 miles into a world of total darkness. We were aboard the U.S. Navy's Apache that discovered the wreck in October 2015, 30 days after El Faro went down. The ship was found upright, but from the mangled name on her stern to her bow, all 791 feet revealed the wounds of a savage beating. She had collided with a hurricane named Joaquin. This is Captain Michael Davidson's last report.
I have a marine emergency, and we had a hull breach. A scuttle blew open during a storm. We have water down in 3 holes with a heavy lift. We've lost the main propulsion unit. The engineers cannot get it going.
Captain Davidson was a 30-year veteran of the sea, married with 2 daughters. His crew included Third Mate Jeremy Ream on the far right, married with a son and a daughter. Danielle Randolph, the second mate, had dreamed of the sea since she was a little girl. and the chief engineer, Richard Puzzateri, had a wife and a baby girl.
This accident was unique in the fact that we didn't have any survivors to interview that would enlighten us to the events and the situation that took place aboard the vessel as they approached the storm.
You were missing a lot of pieces from the jigsaw puzzle.
Absolutely.
The key piece of the puzzle had been denied Brian Young, the safety board's lead investigator. This was El Faro's voyage data recorder, like the voice recorders on airliners. It captured the conversations on the bridge, and it should have been on top of this structure called the house. But the top of the house, the bridge, and the deck below had been ripped away. They were eventually found half a mile from the wreck, but still there was no sign of the voyage data recorder, also called a VDR. The search vessel Apache ran out of time.
The big challenge was locating the VDR, which was only about a foot by 8 inches.
Safety board investigator Eric Stolzenberg returned 6 months later in April of last year with the research vessel Atlantis. Sonar found 150 targets, and they began to visit each one.
So in a way, you're stumbling in the dark, and even though something should be right in front of you, it isn't. It can be 10 more meters off to the left or the right.
It's like crawling on your hands and knees with a flashlight.
That's a good description, yes.
After 5 days, their light flashed on a strip of reflective tape on the VDR. 4 months later, special equipment was brought in to grab it. No commercial recorder had ever been recovered this deep, where the pressure is nearly 7,000 pounds per square inch.
This capsule was contained inside the larger capsule.
Salvaging the clues was up to Jim Ritter's lab at the NTSB in Washington.
This is the actual circuit board that contains the memory. This tiny device with these two memory chips right here contained the entire 26 hours of information from the voyage data recorder.
This card captured the sound from 6 microphones on the bridge. By law, the audio is never released to the public, but investigators produced a 500-page transcript.
It was incredibly moving. We listened to the entire VDR from start to finish, and at the end of it, the team was completely silent. Nobody spoke.
What was it on the tape that moved you so much?
We knew when that recording was going to end, and we knew what a tragic ending it was going to be. Whereas I know the crew did not know that. And that was very difficult for us to watch that clock count down to the end of the recording.
You were listening to the voices of the lost, and you knew it.
Yes, yes. And that was really tough to listen to.
The recording begins the day before the disaster. El Faro was 150 miles from Jacksonville, headed south to Puerto Rico, with a cargo ranging from frozen chickens to cars. Joaquin at the time was just a tropical storm, but Captain Davidson ordered a course change to keep his distance. On the voyage recorder, he's heard saying to the chief mate, "This is why you watch the weather all the time." Later, he predicted, "It should be fine." Then he corrected himself. "Not should be. We're gonna be fine."
What we have learned from the VDR is that multiple weather reports were being sent to the ship. The watch officers on the bridge were receiving weather reports that were printed out in black and white, and mostly text. And then the captain was receiving a graphically depicted weather report in his office every 6 hours.
Which were more accurate?
The ones on the bridge were more accurate in terms of time, whereas the system that the captain received was 6 hours behind.
The weather information the captain was receiving in his office, a deck below the bridge, was 6 hours old.
Correct.
In a storm that is developing more rapidly than most hurricanes ever do.
Correct.
After the storm strengthened into a hurricane, the chief mate, Steve Schultz, suggested another course change, and Davidson agreed. Davidson said, "We'll be passing clear on the backside of it. The faster we're going, the better." Then the captain left the bridge for 8 hours. El Faro had 11 hours left.
How unusual, in your experience, for a captain to be 8 hours in his cabin going into a storm like this?
It's a difficult question to answer. This captain on this accident was convinced that they were on the better side of the storm ready and that they were going to beat the storm. But he was using the information he had, which was outdated, to make these decisions.
That was critical because the hurricane was getting closer, tracking farther south than forecast. At 11 p.m., Third Mate Jeremy Ream called the captain in his quarters to say that in 5 hours, El Faro would be 22 miles from the center, with gusts to 120 and strengthening. After 1 a.m., Second Mate Danielle Randolph called the captain again to say, "It isn't looking good right now." Twice, Ream and Randolph suggested this new route shown in green, but Captain Davidson declined.
Any idea what he's doing down there? Is he asleep?
There were some references made by the mates after the phone call suggesting he may have been sleeping.
Why didn't the junior officers, sensing danger, just decide to change course on their own if the captain wasn't there?
All officers are taught to respect the chain of command and to change the ship's course without the captain's permission is very drastic.
Second Mate Randolph sent an email to her mother, Lori Bobolo.
She never wanted to worry me, but for her to send me an email during to say, heading straight for it, give my love to everyone, she knew. She knew they were doomed. I'm sorry, but she knew.
And when you read that email at that moment?
I knew she was gone. I knew that was it.
At 4 a.m., after 8 hours below, the captain returned to the bridge, saying he'd been sleeping like a baby. Now the storm was upon them. They had 3 hours left. About the heavy seas, Davidson told the crew, "This is every day in Alaska. This is what it's like." But then, Davidson's ship began to fail him. Water was pouring into a cargo hold from an open hatch and a ruptured pipe. El Faro leaned into a 15-degree list. The extreme tilt of the ship caused the engine's lubricating oil to flow away from the pump that was meant to circulate it.
Every indication we've heard from the VDR said that there was a loss of lube oil pressure to the engine.
So now the oil isn't circulating in the engine.
And the engine has safety shutdowns. If there is no oil, the engine will shut itself down.
They are dead in the water.
And at the mercy of the sea.
El Faro was battered by waves as high as 30 feet. Captain Davidson ordered Chief Mate Steve Schultz to investigate the flooding in the hold. Richard Puzzateri, the chief engineer, was fighting to restart the engine. In the audio, the crew on the bridge seems calm, deliberate. One makes coffee, and another says, "Give me the Splenda, not the regular sugar." They had 50 minutes left.
They weren't able to keep up with the water coming in. The list is getting worse. The engine has failed. They're running out of options.
At 7:12 a.m., the captain ordered Second Mate Randolph to send a distress message. Cargo containers crashed overboard. The bow went under.
The abandoned ship signal has sounded, and the captain directs everybody to leave the ship.
But Davidson would not leave the bridge. A crewman was trapped there. The list was so great that the man couldn't climb up to the exit.
Is there panic?
We only hear what's on the bridge, but the captain was extremely calm right to the end.
The crewman said, "You're going to leave me." "I'm not leaving you," Davidson said. "Let's go." "I can't," said the seaman. "I'm a goner." "No, you're not," Davidson urged. "Let's go."
It was not an easy thing to read.
Claudia Schultz is the widow of Chief Mate Steve Schultz.
I didn't let my kids read. Till this day, they haven't read it.
Because it hurts too much?
Yes, it's too painful to read their father's last words.
Tina Ream is the widow of Jeremy Ream, who had suggested a different course.
I felt relief because I was able to read it to know what happened that day. And I read it like I was with him that day, like I was standing there with him reading. So I was relieved I didn't have to use my imagination anymore.
At 7:39 a.m., there was a building rumble. Captain Davidson yelled to his trapped crewman, "It's time to come this way." And the recording ends.
The crew performed heroically, you know, and they didn't just give up.
Frank Pozzateri is the father of the chief engineer, Richard Pozzateri.
The transcript read like a suspense novel, and you were expecting, or I was expecting, oh, it's going to be a happy ending, you know. But, the, you know, going through it, I knew, you know, what I was reading was going to be the end of the vessel and, you know, and the crew.
The safety board's conclusions are expected later this year. Of the 33, not one of the crew was recovered. Their only remains are their words that tell a mariner's story of life and death and the unforgiving sea.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
For 25 years, Jan Creamer and Tim Phillips have made it their mission to stop animal abuse in circuses. They caused a furor in their native England when they released video they'd secretly recorded of one of Britain's most prestigious trainers abusing circus animals. Prosecutors used their footage to convict the trainer of animal cruelty. Then this relentless couple went global, sending teams to infiltrate circuses around the world to document the mistreatment of animals. Their work helped lead to local laws banning most wild animals from circuses in more than 15 U.S. states and to national bans in more than 20 countries. Their latest successes have been across South America, where they spent years recording animal cruelty on hidden cameras. We caught up with Jan and Tim in Peru, along with 24 lucky lions they'd recently rescued from traveling circuses. A warning, some of the pictures later in this report are disturbing. These caged lions have never had it so good. They got to this temporary rescue center thanks to the unrelenting efforts of Jan Creamer and Tim Phillips and members of the organization they founded, Animal Defenders International. Creamer and Phillips told us all 24 lions here had been repeatedly beaten in traveling circuses. The lions sounded like they wanted to tell us themselves.
Hold on, just one second.
This was the first time we had an interview interrupted by roaring.
This is their morning song.
Morning song.
If it was you or I, it'd be, where the hell's my coffee?
I do sound like that when I haven't had my coffee.
Jan and Tim rescue more than lions. They launched their South America campaign after seeing a chimpanzee named Toto chained outside a circus in Chile.
So they'd smashed his teeth to punish him. They were stubbing cigarettes out on him.
Jan shot that picture, and he just gazed across at the Andes. It was almost looked like he was looking mournfully at what he'd lost. Mm. We determined to rescue him, and we took him all the way home to Africa.
A judge, appalled by Toto's treatment, had given custody to Jan and Tim.
Our role is to take them from where they are, where they're suffering, and put them where they need to be.
In South America, their team recorded this hidden camera footage of abuse, which is hard to watch.
What we did was we put a team undercover inside the South American circuses, and they stayed there for almost 2 years, just gathering evidence, filming, photographing. So you're living in the heart of the circus, but that's how you get the really amazing evidence.
Many of their pictures were taken by undercover cameraman Alexis Diaz. When circus workers discovered what he was doing, they beat him up and broke his leg. Still, he kept working to collect evidence.
A lot of our evidence has been used by prosecutors for cruelty convictions. Just one beating of an animal isn't going to secure a conviction. You have to show a pattern of behavior.
Some circuses claim they train wild animals without abuse, using food and positive reinforcement. But Creamer and Phillips insist beatings are routine, because performing tricks is unnatural for wild animals. They only comply out of fear.
And if you've got a dangerous animal, that means subjugation.
Subjugation means beating.
Absolutely. It's all about control and how they're going to make it do what they want it to do. So it's a kick, it's a punch, it's a beating.
And really, we've seen that everywhere we've gone.
This everywhere?
Yeah, in Europe, in America, in South America. There are certain consistencies in the way that these circus animals are looked after.
Using violence is the way that these animals are made to do things that they don't want to do. They don't want to get up and perform. So they have to force them to do it.
So when you made this video evidence public, what was the reaction?
The reaction was instant. I mean, it really was just outrage. And then the politicians were starting to hear about it and saying, well, we should probably have legislation here.
Bolivia was the first country in South America to ban wild animal acts. Other countries have followed suit?
Absolutely. Colombia, Peru, there's over 30 countries.
But in Peru, the new law led to their next challenge, enforcement. Lion acts were outlawed, but local police were not equipped to pick up the lions or care for them. So Jan and Tim said their organization would take in the lions. They brought police for protection during the seizures because the circuses resisted handing over their money makers.
Yeah, they threatened to release the animals into the streets.
Seriously, to let wild animals run through the streets if you come down hard on them.
That's right.
When they raided the circus in Cusco, Peru, they rescued three lions, but the circus refused to release its star attraction, a lion named Smith. The circus demanded police get another court order for Smith. While Jan and Tim worked on that, Smith had to keep performing.
He was unstable and upset because his family had been broken up, and then he was forced into the ring. That was not the time to put someone in the ring with him.
A grade school teacher volunteered to have Smith jump over her. But Smith had other ideas. Amazingly, she jumped right up and was not badly hurt because he'd grabbed her by her collar. Some viewers wanted Smith killed, but Jan and Tim came back to save him. And after what Smith did to the teacher, the circus was forced to give him up. 1 year later, Smith's favorite toys are soccer balls. They don't last long.
Sharp teeth. So have you seen a big difference in his behavior since he came here?
Huge difference.
What's changed?
He's not frightened. He's playful, confident.
How was he before?
Wired. Nervous, neurotic.
Why does he not have a mane?
When you castrate the males, they lose their mane.
Do you have a favorite?
I do have a very soft spot for Leo. So Leo's getting special attention again.
The very first lion we rescued and loaded on this was an old lion called Leo. And he just looked broken. Every tooth had been smashed, all of his canines. And he just looked like he'd given up. Within weeks, his coat was looking healthier. And he's just blossomed. He's like a real kitten again.
He too likes playing with soccer balls, but with few teeth.
He's the one who just gums it?
Yes.
Each ball lasts a lot longer. Rapunzel also has made a remarkable transition. Jan said when they came to take her from the circus, Rapunzel had never been out of her cage.
She'd been born in there. Her mother had died in there. Her father had died in there. And she'd never been outside. So when we brought our cage up to it and we opened the doors to try to transfer her, she was afraid.
Jan said it took more than an hour to entice her out. Rapunzel was also afraid of hay because she'd never seen it. But as you can see, she's gotten over that.
Plenty of circuses like this one still are crisscrossing Peru with lots of human acts to entertain. But the government told us, thanks to the efforts of Jan and Tim, there are no more wild animals, not a single one, still performing in Peru.
Lions that had been malnourished now get to feast on whole chickens. After plenty of food and medical attention, Jan and Tim found them a permanent home at a sanctuary in South Africa. But that would mean a long flight from Peru, and they'd have to coax 24 skittish lions into travel crates in time for takeoff. Tim told us the transfers would be tricky and dangerous.
Might have a few problems. Worst case scenario is we have to anesthetize an animal to get them loaded in order to catch the flight. There can be problems with it. The big lion anesthetic, it does lead to seizures.
The transfers didn't start well.
Come on, people. Have all night.
But then, one by one, they lured the lions into their crates.
That was easy. God, he's a big fella.
Several objected to the smaller space.
Okay, this one needs to be moved.
This is going quite well.
We're actually really fast.
Smith, who had dragged the teacher, also seemed ready to leave. Finally, the last lion was reluctant Rapunzel. Remember during her rescue, it took more than an hour to get her to leave her circus cage? Once again, she refused to leave the known for the unknown. With time running out, they had to tranquilize her.
This is the scariest thing that we have to do with an animal. But we had no choice but to do it. She wasn't settling down.
Uno, dos, tres.
Fearing she could suffer a seizure, they quickly gave Rapunzel the antidote and hoped they'd given it to her in time.
She's awake.
She should be okay now.
The cages are empty. They really are. That feels good.
The drive to the airport began what would be a 2-day journey. Jan, Tim, and Yvette flew with the lions without incident. Then, in South Africa, we caught up with them being transported through the countryside after what had been the biggest lion airlift in history. 33 lions, including 9 rescued from Colombia.
Seeing these animals, when you've taken them to as close as we can give them to freedom, really is what it's all about.
The lions still are fenced in, but they have plenty of room to roam, more than 30 acres. These cats couldn't survive in the wild. Most don't have claws, and their teeth have been smashed. Here, they'll get fed, and they can bask in a world of new experiences. Many had never stepped on grass, had never touched a tree. Life's simple pleasures, long denied.
Now an update on a story we called Passports for Sale. In January, Steve Croft reported how some small countries earn revenue selling passports, even diplomatic passports, to a rogues gallery of scoundrels, fugitives, and tax cheats. On the Caribbean island of Dominica, he spoke with Lennox Linton, a member of parliament.
I assume that you've asked the prime minister.
Yes.
How he ended up appointing these people diplomats.
Yes.
And what was the answer?
The prime minister doesn't answer those questions.
On Dominica, our story, the resulting political demonstrations, and the arrest of an international fugitive traveling on a Dominican diplomatic passport prompted some reforms. The Prime Minister has announced a tightening of passport rules. Now, wealthy foreigners seeking diplomatic passports will at least be checked for a criminal record and must report the source of their funds. I'm Scott Pelley. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.
We're in Rome to meet Pope Francis for a rare, wide-ranging interview.
Do you like when you are called the people's pope?
El Papa de la gente.
It is very important to talk about the future. You have called for a ceasefire. Can you help negotiate peace?
Join us for our special hour with His Holiness on CBS.
Pope Francis the First, a CBS News primetime special, tomorrow on CBS and streaming on Paramount Plus.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. Okay. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene,
there were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.